Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 19th of November 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live at radioalbion.com. We do like to do live shows every so often. This is one of them and it means I have my co-host with me for today, which is the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, how are you doing? What's life like for you? You doing well?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. Back home to see family this weekend. Yeah, how are you?
Pretty good. I've been working on this and finding some more quotes from the Mummies of Urumqi book, which we'll use tonight, and we'll also talk a little bit about Buddha. Okay. It's quite an interesting subject. I mean, it's not very often that nationalists talk about China and the Aryan element in China. I guess we should call it Aryan because it's not European. I guess we could call it Indo-Aryan, but it's not often that it really gets talked about. So it's it's quite original, I think. And I've had some good reports about this series as well. I keep hearing from people saying that they're really enjoying the series and it's really starting to grow on them and starting to go places as well. Are you finding it interesting so far?
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's a side of history which is relatively unknown or not discussed. It's important though, isn't it?
Yeah,
to understand.
So it's certainly not discussed from our viewpoint, and a lot of it they try to obfuscate the white parts to the history, and they'll try to portray it as if it was Chinese people or if it was Asian people or Iraqi people. So it's important that we get the ethnicities right. And I'm hoping that we're providing enough evidence to show that the people that we're talking about were actually white. They weren't the same sort of people that are living in that area now. Do you want to add to that?
No, I mean, we've made similar points in the past, about that, really. You can't really base the people living in a present location and assume the identity of the past inhabitants would be the same. It's just like, you know, how you can see a projection of Europe in 300-400 years. You know, it's kind of the same thing happened in the past in those areas.
It would be kind of like looking at Detroit today and thinking that Henry Ford must have been black. And the most obvious instance of it is people looking at Israel today and saying, well, Jesus must have been a Jew or he must have looked like a Palestinian. And that's the most common instance of it. Well, let's start with a little recap. Last week, we were talking about the Caucasian mummies found in the Tarim Basin. And we moved on from that to talking about the Scythians and particularly the Sakya tribe, who moved to the west into Europe and became known as the Saxons, and moved to the east through the Tarim Basin and into India and Indochina, bringing Buddhism with them. And we went into quite some details with a quote from a very old book talking about the various ways that the word Sakya had evolved over time until it became the Saxons in the west. But we're really going to be concentrating on the east, and in particular this area, this Tarim Basin area. And these Sakyas, that was actually the tribe that Buddha came from. And if you look Sakya up, it tells you that Sakya is derived from the word Saka, which is the precise people that we've just been discussing and that we were discussing last week. And his enlightenment occurred in what is now Nepal. And the people there today are a mixed race of Indo-Aryans crossed with East Asians. And his actual name was Siddhartha Buddha. Yeah.
Siddhartha.
Yeah.
I don't think you can get any more sort of typically English, could you?
No.
Arthur.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at it, I mean, the way they sort of pronounce it is Siddhartha, but it is Siddhartha. And it's the same people in the West that it was in the East. So obviously we're going to have similar names. He was also known as the Sakyamuni, which was the sage of the Shakyas. Basically, there's a lot of tying in with this Sakya word. And if you look it up on Wikipedia, it tells you that they say that he came from the Scythians, basically. And this Sakya tribe was a Scythian tribe. And as we mentioned last week, the actual name itself can, the Sakya word itself can mean a people that have been removed from their original land, which is what had happened.
Really?
Yeah, which is what had happened to the Israelites as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of, you give labels based on a descriptive form, don't you, to kind of, to root it in some kind of truth. So it just adds another dimension to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, and when you think about Buddhism, it's like a rejection of everything, and it's quite rejection of worldly riches and all those things. And if you think the Israelites had lost all of that, they'd lost everything, so they had to find some way of coping without having anything and having lost everything. And maybe Buddhism tied in with that. It was just one particular group of them that ended up heading off to the east, and one of them, the prince, this Siddhartha, he was the one that attained enlightenment, supposedly. And then after that, there were lots of other Buddhas, and Buddhism made its way into China. It actually made its way into Tibet really rather late. I can't think of the exact date. It may have even been the 11th century AD. It certainly wasn't very, very early in Tibet. And when L.A. Waddell went there, he was hoping to find the earliest Tibetan records of the beginning of the Aryans, basically. And he was hoping to find these really early Buddhist records. But he discovered that, in actual fact, in Tibet, it was one of the latest places to actually become Buddhist. And their Buddhism was all syncretized with paganism and had more in common with paganism than Buddhism. But he actually discovered the birthplace of Buddha and lots of bits and pieces to do with his life they discovered in India. So he was a real person, and he was from this tribe. And originally it was just oral teachings that they had, and then they wrote them down after that. As I say, go on.
I remember when I was, I kind of fell away from a Christian faith early on, and I remember reading up on Buddhism, and even then I saw the similarities in it. So you can definitely sense that they've got kind of Aryan roots in there, because it's rooted in the soul, isn't it? The same soul of a person, and I think I think that's where the similarities come from.
And the rejection of materialism as well is a very European way of looking at things. That's why we took to Christianity so well. But when you think about it, though, the actual central point of it, like nirvana, which is blending with God, becoming one with God, and it's essentially not knowing anything, because you know everything. And once you know everything, and everything becomes a blur, everything becomes the same, and there's actually no knowledge, and it becomes the same as when you're in a deep sleep. So it really is a false teaching. The actual nirvana, the final end point that you're hoping to reach in Buddhism, it would mean that there was no knowledge at all, and you wouldn't have any sensation or anything. Well, you would just have bliss, but then in order to have bliss, you would have to understand what was the opposite of bliss. So it wouldn't really work out. There's a really good astrologer by the name of Julian Lee, who used to have quite a few websites up, and he promotes celibacy, and he's done a lot of work into this and showing that Buddhism is a false teaching for that aspect. And he looks at the Aryan side of all these religions as well. But I haven't heard from him for a long time. He's also a musician, really good guy, Julian Lee. Perhaps you might be listening. I also had a look on Robert Sepper's site. Robert Sepper is an interesting researcher. He's going into the early Aryan origins.
He's got some great videos. I've listened to and watched a lot of his stuff on YouTube, and he's quite genuine with a lot of the stuff. I don't agree wholeheartedly on all of his stuff, because he as a paleontologist, he kind of reports on a lot of different findings, so I don't think he has a kind of a bias in anywhere in particular, but he does generally report on a lot of unspoken kind of history.
Yeah, he's open to different ideas, and he's certainly open to alternative hypotheses about history. He's aware of the untruths that we're told about World War II, which is quite rare in paleontologists, anthropologists.
Yeah, he's brought up, and we're going off a bit here, at least I am, but something he talks a lot about is the secrets of Vril, and some interesting theories on what happened with the Nazis after in Antarctica. So there's quite some spicy subjects there.
Yeah, he's into the New Agey sort of stuff. That's the bits that I tend to sort of leave alone with him, and Atlantis and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, but well, that would be a pretty cool kind of ending, you know, to have to think that there is some kind of, you know, NS base deep in the Antarctic somewhere ready to save the West the day of reckoning.
Yeah, that was really big in the 70s as well, actually, the secret Antarctica Nazis and the secret base there. But yeah, I was looking on his website to find out about the Blue-Eyed Buddha of China. There used to be something that went into this in quite some detail some years back, but I just wasn't able to find it. So I found Robert Sepper's summary, and he talks about Bodhidharma, who was a Buddhist monk who lived during the 5th and 6th century AD. And he is credited as being the transmitter of Zen Buddhism to China, and he is regarded as its first Chinese patriarch. So he was the first central figure in China of the Chinese, which is really late when you think about it. Buddhism itself came about in the 5th, 6th century BC. So this must be talking about 1,000 years later when it actually came to China. I know it made its way to Thailand. From India, it made its way down to Thailand, and then by the time it got to China, it was pretty much finished in India. It sort of burns, and then it burns itself out, basically, Buddhism does, as it travels itself around. Not like Christianity, which sort of has stayed for the whole of the last 2,000 years in the countries that it took root in Europe.
I wonder, you know, why that was then, and maybe the people that brought it kind of are essentially responsible or required to, you know, to perpetuate it. And so once those people kind of ceased to be in those lands, maybe that's where it died with them.
Well, I think you're right there. I do think you're right there. And the book that we're actually quoting from last week, The Saxons of the East and the West, that talks a little bit about that. When they get down, because the author traces this group, the Sakya tribe, until they get down somewhere in Indochina, in Thailand, and you can see the ruins there. There's people living amongst the ruins. And obviously the people that were living there originally were quite technologically proficient. And they have this legend that the people that actually built this place, they had a sacred book, and a cockerel knocked the sacred book off from the altar, and it landed on the ground, and the swine kicked it over, and they lost all the knowledge that was in the sacred book. And that seems like a sort of fable to me, like don't cast your pearls before swine.
Yeah.
And as if it's passing that story on. And also that the people that are there now are obviously not the same ethnicity of the people that brought Buddhism to that area. It's like we were just saying just then about the people that are there now in Nepal. They're a cross between Indo-Aryan and East Asian. And the people that are in this part of Thailand, they're a cross of Indo-Aryan with South China, I guess you would call it. Or Thai. When we look at any of these other races, they nearly always seem to have a certain percentage of what we would call European DNA today. It's really like Indo-Aryan, and it can be from various points in history. If you think when Alexander the Great made his way all the way up to India, a lot of their DNA was left along the route. And then before that, there was the Mesopotamian civilization and the Indus River Valley one as well. But talking about China here, according to Chinese legend, Bodhidharma also began the physical training of the Shaolin monks that led to the creation of Shaolin Quin. And the Anthology of the Patriarchal Hall identifies Bodhidharma as the 28th patriarch of Buddhism in an uninterrupted line that extends all the way back to the Buddha himself. And throughout Buddhist art, he is depicted as profusely bearded with wide eyes and is referred to as the blue-eyed barbarian in Chinese Chan texts. So what it's saying there is it's an uninterrupted line, obviously not father to son, but as the leader of Buddhism. So he was the 28th leader of Buddhism, worldwide Buddhism, and he was quite clearly a white man. When you hear of somebody who is profusely bearded, originally the Negroes didn't have beards. The only reason why some of them have a sort of beard today is because they've become interbred with white people.
Yeah, I mean, Chinese don't tend to have so much facial hair either, do they?
No.
Modern-day Chinese.
It was associated with white people, and this was one of the things that they said a couple of hundred years ago. They would look at black people and they would say, well, this is evidence that they're a childlike race because they don't grow beards. And the most mature race is the white race because we have these big, healthy, luxurious beards. And then you can look at the Chinese and you can say, well, they're about halfway, aren't they? Because they do have sort of like little tufty beards. Mm. It's a strange logic, but it sort of makes sense when you think about it. Well, they call him the blue-eyed barbarian. He's also pictured with red hair as well. And if you think this is the patriarch of China, basically. First Chinese patriarch, and he was a white man. New archaeological finds in China are forcing a re-examination of old Chinese books that describe historical or legendary figures of great height with deep-set blue or green eyes, long noses, full beards, and red or blonde hair. Scholars have traditionally scoffed at these accounts, but it now transpires that these accounts were correct. Many people are also unaware of the fact that China has massive pyramids that rival Egypt in size and age. And I haven't properly looked into those, but we do get pyramids all over the place, don't we? I think they've got, might even have some in Serbia. They've got some in South America, but they're not block pyramids like the ones that they have in Egypt. It's just mainly this shape that
different structure. I guess they have different, more flat-based levels to them, don't they, I think?
Yeah. Yeah, and they're not in such good condition. It can be similar to Silbury Hill. Am I getting the name right? I should remember it. The man-made mound that we've got in Wiltshire. It's the highest man-made mound in Europe, I think.
Right.
It's something similar to that is what they have in China, rather than these block-built tombs like the ones in Egypt. So China's landscape is not only littered with enormous pyramids, but hundreds of ancient blonde mummies with Caucasoid features. The discoveries in the 1980s of the undisturbed 4,000-year-old beauty of Lulan and the younger 3,000-year-old body of the Chechen Man are legendary in world archaeological circles for the fine state of their preservation and for the wealth of knowledge that they bring to modern research. And those are the mummies that we were talking about last week. And I had another look through The Mummies of Urumqi by Elizabeth Whalen Barber, and I pulled out a couple of quotes that I thought would be interesting to go into, which are talking about later on, because we talked about how there must have been white people there. They must have been from Mesopotamia and the Indus River Valley at the time when these people died, sort of 4,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. And then after that, we talked about the Scythians and how they moved there from the area that they were in, which is above Assyria. And after that, we then had Alexander the Great moving through there, and that's who Elizabeth Whalen Barber is talking about here. So I thought we could...
Did many of their men, and during the expansion with Alexander, you think many of the men would have settled and intermingled with them, yeah?
Yes, yeah, because they built cities.
Right.
So they would have stayed there. And as you were pointing out when we did that series, he spread himself out too far. And when he tried mm-hmm. to build up this infrastructure, that's why it sort of all fell apart at the end, because he'd spread himself too thinly. And the reason for that is because he was building infrastructure and building cities as he went. So he would have left some people there wherever he went, directing the people, as it were.
So they would have likely stayed and just become swamped, really, as opposed to expand and dominate genetically. They would have been kind of just swallowed up by the surrounding. And anyone that did stay there that was white or Aryan would have just kind of been absorbed, right?
Eventually. I'm not sure it happened that quickly, because once he'd made his way to India and through Persia, there was a route there for the Greeks to get from Greece to India. So the Greeks did travel there, and that this is why we find evidence of Greek art, basically, right, all the way through, which it talks about here. Right, these are these quotes from the Mummies of Urumqi by Elizabeth Whalen Barber. The various mummies and their belongings show us that people in general, and Iranians in particular, had long been moving through Central Asia by several paths, living along the trackways and leaving their dead to mummify in the sands behind them. And of course, Iran was only called Iran from, I think, 1940 onwards. And they took their name because they approved of what the Germans were doing with their research into Aryanism. And Iran, it comes from the word Aryan, but back then it was obviously Persia. So this is where some of this confusion can come in, you see, because she knows what she's talking about, but she's referring to them as Iranians, but they're actually Persians. The first history books indicate much the same. The Greek writer Herodotus led the way, coining the very term history in the 5th century BC, while researching the course of the wars between the Greeks and the Persians. He mentions the vast eastward extent of the Persian Empire, which King Darius himself boasted as stretching all the way to Gandhar, the modern plain of Peshawar in northwestern Pakistan. Although his hostilities kept Herodotus from going to Persia, he did visit as many places important to the war as he could, and he reported all he could hear tell of it. Unfortunately for our purposes, this was far more about customs than geography, but Herodotus was an excellent observer. At one point, he remarks in disgust at the glee the Persian magi seemed to take in killing victims for their famous divinations. But then he concludes philosophically, "But as for this custom, let it be as it was established long ago. I will return to my narrative."
All right, that's interesting. So, I mean, a lot of this kind of information, I'm surprised, kind of still has survived a lot of the Chinese kind of communist revolution. I know a lot of the history has been kind of hidden or destroyed, really, at least the more recent cultural history. So anything that kind of dates back connecting, you know, Aryans to China, should be really long gone, I'd have thought.
Well, they don't seem too bad, actually, the Chinese. I mean, they've put these mummies out there, and they are not happy about the Uyghurs claiming the white mummies as their own. They say, no, these are Europeans, they're not Chinese, because the Uyghurs try to use it to say, well, this is our claim over the area, these are our ancestors, and the Chinese aren't happy for that.
The Uyghurs, do you say?
Yeah. Yeah,
can you just clarify,
the Uyghurs area.
Who were they?
Well, they were a Turkic people. They were part of the Turkic-speaking tribes. There are various Turkic-speaking tribes, which I guess today Turkey would be one of the largest, but you've got Turkmenistan and the Tartars, and there was some of them were in Ukraine, some of them were in China, and they came in after the Caucasians. They were the first ones, really, that set up China with the Turkic-speaking peoples.
But after the white people. They're still kind of Caucasian types.
Well, they're mixed. But they do show some European features, but they're Turkic peoples, basically. They're mixed between Mongolian and European, I would say.
Right, okay. And, there's the whole Tartarian Empire, which... I'm not sure if it's relevant to patriotic history or not, but I know there's a lot going on there in the past.
Well, that's probably quite a bit further on. I mean, the bit that interests me here is about these Persian magi killing victims. I mean, that's sort of human sacrifice, and that's not really very often associated with white people, but we did do things like that in the past, sadly. You know, you can't just say it was only non-whites that had these abominable customs. We did as well sometimes.
It was pretty much doing stuff like that just after World War. Surely the, what was it? What did the Nazis? I forget the name of it. Special word.
Well, no. What they're doing here is doing it for divination purposes, so that they can tell the future. That's what these magi were doing. They were killing victims.
Divination, is that what it means? Divination.
Yeah, telling the future, not torturing them to get information out of them.
That is quite pagan-esque, isn't it? In witchcrafty type.
Yeah, stuff. And it may not be right to call them magi if you think of the magi that are in the New Testament that come to see Jesus. They were I wouldn't have thought they were involved in killing victims for divinations. I mean, this is how far back is this? 5th century BC. So I guess it may have been to do with Zoroastrianism. That would have been around at the time.
Possibly.
Well, Alexander the Great, who lived a century later, did not let others stand in his way. He went to Persia himself. In 334 BC, having subdued his enemies in Macedonia, Greece, and the Balkans, and receiving, amongst others, a warily friendly embassy of Celts, he set out to conquer Asia and the barbarians who had attacked Greece 150 years before. Landing first at Troy on the northwestern tip of Anatolia, he sacrificed to the gods who had helped the Greeks conquer that corner of Asia 900 years earlier. He had studied Hellenic history well, his tutor being none other than Aristotle. By 331 BC, Alexander had fought his way across Anatolia, Syria, and Babylonia to the Tigris rivers and beyond. Upon entering one conquered city, he found a famous Greek statue of two tyrant slayers, an artwork carried off by the Persian king who sacked Athens in 480 BC. Delightedly, he sent the piece back home to Greece, both because he admired Greek art and as a political statement. The next year, moving into what is now Iran, he captured the royal city and palace at Pasargadae, called Persepolis by the Greeks, and put such a hoard of gold from its royal treasury back into circulation that the world gold market got its first Black Monday. Then, after some moving to secure his flanks, he marched east again. And let's just stop there, I mean, because that tells us that the world was all connected up, doesn't it? I mean, if once he releases this gold in, the whole world gold market crashes, everybody was connected up. They must have been able to communicate. The whole of the civilized world must have been talking to one another, had communication with one another.
It probably wasn't as... it didn't branch out as far as it does today, but I think there would have likely been... trade markets or kind of industries that were connected within the more civilized areas of the world for sure,
and roadways between them, and people racing about on horseback with mail, with the equivalent of our postal service today, so that people could get messages across as well.
Yeah, I was speaking about that with the wife the other day actually. The mail system back then was probably quite expensive, wasn't it? So I'd have thought that you'd have to be quite well off in order to send mail back then. Was that true, do you think? Or
it might be a subject worth looking into, actually, in the series about the mail. I mean, we covered it a bit in the Mesopotamia, didn't we? They were the first ones to have a mail system, and they could send tablets from one part of the country to the other. But yeah, maybe we could look at that.
What it required, I mean, it's, you know, you've got a letter, and I can't imagine that unless they had some way of distributing it, so you had one person go into a particular region, and then from there it was redistributed into more fractal kind of posts, you know, as opposed to one person going from a specific destination to a specific destination.
It would be important people, wouldn't it? It would be messages for the king, possibly messages for some of the nobles, and it would get taken to the palace and probably then distributed from there. Something like that, I would have thought. Yeah. It's worth looking into. I think that might be an interesting subject. First, Alexander swung northeast into the area of Bactria on the Oxus River. And remember, he's in the sort of Pakistan-Afghanistan area here now. And to get up to the Tarim Basin is just up above that, sort of halfway between there and Beijing. So he's in the area of Bactria on the Oxus River, which he conquered with little fighting but much hardship in the cold mountains. The Greek colonies he set up in this province were they that 2 centuries later recorded the arrival and eventual departure of the Tokharoi. And that's the Tokharians, which is another important group that ended up going to the Tarim Basin. And they're not quite sure who they were, but we've got pictures of them. And again, they're definitely white people. And I'll put the pictures of them with this podcast. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the book is actually about the Tokharoi or the Tokharians. Alexander himself got as far northeast as the point where the Shedaria flows out of the Fergana Valley into the desert plains. There in 328 BC, he founded one of the many towns he built along the way and named it after himself, this one being Alexander Eskete, Alexandria the Furthest. After many adventures in Bactria, including the marriage to a beautiful captive named Roxanne, Alexander turned south in 327 BC to conquer the Indus River Valley in today's Pakistan, entering via its northwestern tributary, the Kabul River and the Khyber Pass. So he's in Afghanistan there as well. In Gandhar or Peshawar, as elsewhere, he built cities on the Greek model and moved on. By 325, he and his army had reached the mouth of the Indus, and after a brief sail into the Indian Ocean, he began to work his way overland back home, some 3,000 miles away to the northwest. He got as far as Babylon before falling sick of a fatal fever, and in June of 323 BC, he died at the age of 32. According to one tradition, his body was encased in honey to preserve it for the long journey back to his beloved city of Alexandria in Egypt, where he wished to be buried. So he's been all up round the area close to the Tarim Basin. Well, Alexander was dead, but Greek influence in Central Asia was not. In Bactria in particular, Greek rulers and colonists remained and spread their canons of art amongst the other inhabitants. Thus, when the Tokharoi, originally from the Tarim Basin, eventually left Bactria for India, they took Greek ideals with them to their new kingdom of Gandhar, where the Kabul and Swat rivers flow together into the upper Indus. Converted to Buddhism, the Tokharoi merged the Greek and Indian traditions into the delicate style known today as Gandharan or Greco-Buddhist art, which came to flower in the first millennium AD. Then they carried it north with their Buddhist teachings over the Karakoram Pass to Khotan and the other oases of the southern Tarim Basin, where Stein was so startled to find it when he arrived and began excavating in 1900. So when they first sort of dug this up, they were really surprised to find all this Greek art in this area. And little were they to know that it actually there'd been white people there for the last 4,000 years. Back and forth and to and fro, the passing of ideas from east and west clearly has a long history, and dry, sandy Central Asia served as the main corridor for that until quite recently. Some have tried to wish away the evidence for such transcontinental contacts, believing that independent invention confers the greatest glory. But global research shows that isolation and not contact is the enemy of a progressive and vibrant civilization. The Tasmanians, for instance, cut off for several thousand years from the rest of humanity, not only made no progress, but actually backslid, losing one important skill after another, such as how to make bone tools, including needles for sewing clothes, and how to haft handles into stone blades, to make tools capable of felling trees and hollowing out boats. A fatal loss. Again, I'll just stop there because I would suggest that if they once knew how to do all of this and then they forgot how to do it, then they lost the ethnicity that knew how to do it, because the same thing happened in the Indus River Valley, didn't it? They forgot how to write, yeah. They forgot how to do everything. And it was because they had blended themselves out. They stopped being the original people that were there. If you have a people that build a civilization and they lose their ethnicity and they become blended out with a people that don't know how to build a civilization, that civilization is going to collapse. It's just logic.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's either that or the only other explanation I could think of is if the people didn't need to know that knowledge for a certain period of time, or they got dependent on other people producing and therefore forgot. But it sounds like the kind of skills that were required, it's not like they would have had some other means of production, people facilitating them skills for them, would they? They'd have still, them skills would have always been relied upon.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to say. So it's not like it would have kind of been lost time in that respect. So it must have just been the ability to maintain and preserve.
Well, you think tools capable of felling trees and hollowing out boats. I mean, somebody else must have came out with the ideas of how to do that. And eventually the people that were there forgot how. I mean, you can't just forget how to do something. You can't forget the inspiration to innovate. But you could end up with a people that never had that inspiration to innovate in the first place, that would not understand how to put the things together to make them work.
Yeah, and I don't think they would have just like forgot. It would have just been a kind of a reversal, you know, as you kind of, in any creative process, you build on the ideas that came before it. And then you build on top of that and find new ways to do things, and you expand and build and develop and refine. And I can imagine that, people with a lackluster spirit in terms of how to, innovate, it would have just been an absolute reversal. And so they'd kind of go down, take it down a peg and kind of cut corners here. And then it just begets, a worse version, a worse iteration. And then, before you know it, it doesn't float anymore. And it's like, okay, let's just not bother using boats. Let's just, let's walk around.
Yeah, it's like
that's pretty much how it goes down, I reckon.
Like if you don't know how to reverse engineer something and something goes wrong, then you're not going to know how to fix it, are you? And I think we're seeing something similar happen with South Africa at the moment. We're watching the civilization fall apart there. All the power stations, all the power cuts, the hospitals, and because they don't know how to do it for themselves. It was handed to them already made.
Is that the Boers? They're kind of not really involved anymore at all, or?
Well, because of the diversity quotas, they've only allowed a certain percentage of white people involved in anything. And right. Because of these diversity quotas have got to be in every aspect of every industry, it means that you've got people that don't know what they're doing that are right at the top of right. businesses and industries. And, yeah, and they've been put there by the African National Congress because they know them, but they have no idea how to do the job. And I think it would be back to looking like the rest of Africa within 10 years if it doesn't look like it now.
Yeah. Well, there's the classic case of Zimbabwe, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah, just look at Zimbabwe, former Rhodesia. I mean, how long did that take? 30 years, 40 years to go back to how it is now? New contact. Oh, and also Haiti. I mean, just look at Haiti.
That was quite bloody, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they got rid of all the mixed race people as well. They didn't just get rid of all the white people. They then got rid of all the mixed race people as well. They slaughtered all of them. So they just had blacks left. And it's, I think, three times they've helped out Haiti now and tried to put it right. And three times it's all fallen apart again. Obviously, liberals will say, well, they've got hurricanes and all sorts of climate problems. But they had all of those when white people were running it. And it was known as a paradise. It was an absolute paradise.
And it was mostly French occupied, wasn't it?
And then they had the French Revolution and... In Europe, And then the blacks had a similar French Revolution over there. And they just slaughtered everyone that knew how to do anything, ended up being killed.
Yeah.
New contacts among diverse peoples, on the contrary, spark creative new ways of looking at things. For example, every major improvement in writing systems came when new arrivals said, in effect, well, this is wonderful, but there must be an even better way. And again, if you're going to have new contacts, then obviously the people that are contacting you are travellers, and they're obviously up to a certain technological standard to be able to travel and to be able to survive while they're travelling about. So it's going to be white people that make contact with these peoples. I mean, we haven't had Africans, black Africans, come and make contact in Europe, did we? It's Europeans that go and make contact in New Guinea with these new tribes. So the people that come, the new arrivals, are going to be up to a certain intellectual standard that they are going to be able to improve things.
Well, that's it. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people that blame whites for so many atrocities and things like this that have gone off in the world. And, you know, the biggest responsible for, like, the most amount of killings and murders in wars and stuff, but I think it's kind of, it correlates with greatness, doesn't it? And on the one hand, you've got greatness which enables you to travel far and wide and build up great empires and civilizations, and so with that, you know, greatness, you just have a natural proportion of kind of atrocity or downfall and evil. So it's just, you know, how far a pendulum can swing left, it's kind of in equal measure will swing further right. So, you know, the other races can't really have that claim because they haven't had the chance or ability to reach those heights before.
You can't raise people up either. You know, you can't really raise people up. All you can do is squash people down to the lowest common denominator. I mean, this thing that Boris Johnson is doing at the moment, leveling up, it's impossible. You can't level up. And if you're doing plastering or smoothing anything down, in order to get it all level, you have to flatten it. You squash it down. You don't bring things up to make everything level. You squash it down. And just a point here about what it's saying about what it's essentially saying is when you have diverse peoples, it sparks new ways of looking at things. That's true. If you have diverse peoples that are all of a certain intellect, then they're going to have different ways of doing things. If they're all of a certain intellect, if you just have diverse peoples for the sake of diverse peoples, then it's just going to be at the lowest. Everything's going to get done at the standard of the lowest of those diverse peoples. That's the problem with it.
Of course, it's. It's just classic communism, isn't it? Really,
yeah.
The lie of equality and bringing everything down to the average, so that you don't have the excellent thinkers and the forerunners and people innovating, and because they're just not required in the world that they want to see, where they kind of rule supreme.
No room for excellence.
No.
There was, in fact, an amazing amount of traffic all over Central Asia long before the Silk Road came into being. That great east-west passage became established as a trade route only during Roman times, concurrent with China's Han dynasties, 202 BC to AD 220, and trade flourished. So that's when the Chinese people really began in China, was 200 BC. You know, it's very late. Chinese silk became the envy of the upper-class ladies of the Roman Empire, while Central Asia costumes and dances became all the rage among the ladies of the Han court, along with Roman glass. In this book, most of the movement has been from west to east, but later the flow largely reversed and China's influence on Europe became enormous. Chinese gunpowder alone forever changed the Western way of life and death. The reverse flow clearly shows among the Tarim mummies too. Between 2000 and 1000 BC, they are entirely Caucasian in features, whereas by 300 BC, bodies with Mongoloid features mingle with the Westerners, for example, the Chai Weagle body. The Tokharian paintings of AD 600 to 1000 AD show Buddhist devotees of many races, Chinese, Indian, Mongol, and Turkic types, as well as fair-haired, blue-eyed, white-cheeked Caucasians. And the mummies tell the same tale, with ever-increasing percentages of Turkic, Mongol, and finally, Chinese types. In fact, the last mummy in the Urumqi Museum Gallery is that of a Chinese general. He is far smaller than Churchin Man, with a very different facial structure. If you walk the streets of Urumqi today, you will see mostly Chinese faces, except in the bazaars. There, amidst the babble of spice sellers, noodle vendors, and cloth merchants, you will still hear many varieties of Turkic languages, Uyghur and Kazakh being the most prominent. And you will see many non-Chinese faces and modes of dress. And here and there, you will spot someone with honey blonde hair and perhaps even blue eyes. So you still got that trace of us being there 4,000 years later, and they can see in the bodies, I mean all the bodies are white people at first for 1,000 years, and then you start getting Mongol Turkic types, and then Mongol types, and then finally you get the Chinese types that were buried there.
So the Chinese type is essentially where I think everything would be fully leveled out to the point where you wouldn't get as sporadic spikes in the genome, because it becomes so mixed over time. It's like, you know, cordial juice. You know, when it mixes, it's so, the consistency is so fine. I guess that's when you get a category of an ethnic type, then, don't you?
Yeah, I think that's
what I'm trying to say.
I think the Chinese type is probably a mix of Turkic and European. And maybe Mongolian as well.
But the point I'm making is now they've come to a point where they all look quite similar.
Oh yeah.
And so the fluctuations in the genome is less apparent. So they would have been fully mixed and interwoven, really, to become a distinct ethnic type.
Yeah, they call them a cline then, which is like a stabilized mixed racial type.
Right, so there is an actual scientific term for it.
Yeah, it's a cline, and the Red Indians are known to be a cline as well. They're known to have come about through a mix of different types, and occasionally you'll still get signs of one of these types. I mean, there's also the Ainu in Japan. They were a white race that were in Japan. And obviously the originators of what became Chinese civilization, they were white people.
I wonder then, because the Chinese and the Japanese, I mean, if you ask anyone, you know, what are they renowned for culturally, you'd think kind of samurai warriors and whatnot, I guess, and ninjas. And so I wonder if by that time, were they intermingled and mixed, or could you argue a case that the true ninjas were, Aryan?
Well, it says here that the monk, that Bodhidharma, and he started the Shaolin monks, he was white, and he was the patriarch. I mean, I don't really follow Chinese martial arts much, but are the Shaolin monks, are they to do with the samurais or martial arts?
I think martial arts came a little bit after, but it was definitely born out of fighting warrior spirit, that's for sure. And I think the samurai was probably going back, I don't know, say 500 AD maybe. I'm not too sure. I'm just saying stereotypically, you know, what Japan and China are renowned for, and I just wonder, given the fact that we're looking at Aryan's influence on ancient China, I just wonder, you know, how much of that influence could have been on the stereotypical historic parts of the past.
Well, I think it would have been us right at the beginning, up until about 1000 BC, and then it would have been mixed people.
And then you got to 1000 BC.
Yeah.
All right. Maybe I'll do a quick Google.
That would be my estimate. Because you've also got the terracotta warriors, and lots of those terracotta warriors are Caucasian. They're not Chinese. And then after after this, you also get Marco Polo that was going over to China. And he was conversing with Europeans
there. I've heard the name Marco Polo, and there's a pasta dish named Marco Polo in Italy. But
he's quite famous in that part of the world. He's probably more famous in China than he is in Italy, where he originally came from. And I'm trying to think, when was the time of that? I think that was after 1000 AD. Probably about 1200 AD, something like that, is when Marco Polo was supposedly over there.
Right, okay. Well, I just had a quick look. And apparently it was 1185, Japan began to be governed by warriors or samurai or so. So maybe towards the end of our own influence.
Well, we haven't looked at Japan yet.
What's that, sorry?
We haven't looked at Japan yet either.
No.
I mean, we're looking at China just, and Taran.
Maybe it would be kind of a side, a bit of extra research we can come back to next week, just to touch on that, from stereotypical historic points of ancient China and Japan.
Well, yeah, there's this group, the Ainu, spelled A-I-U-N-E, something like that, A-A-I-U-N-E. And I actually, bizarrely enough, I saw a tweet, a black supremacist tweet claiming that the Ainu were actually black Japanese.
Right,
they're actually white. They don't really exist anymore, but they're recorded as being white and having Caucasian features.
I think that they're just hilarious, really, because they go on this breadcrumb trail, and it's kind of like they'll get to a point, and it's almost like a wall, and it's like, oh, well, we've come this far, and we're obviously the identity of, the people with all this heritage, and we've come to this point now where we must be these new people, because otherwise it invalidates all the other kind of history. So it's just, and so they start to, it's like you're telling a lie, you have to tell more lies and more lies in order to, kind of mask the...
Chinese whispers.
Yeah, pretty much.
Chinese whispers. Well, the biggest evidence, I think, actually, of us being over there, the biggest evidence is actually found in Korea, where over 200,000 megalithic structures have been recorded, with 90% of them being in South Korea, where they have the status of protected monuments. Most of the stones used are massive, with the largest example found being 5.5 meters wide and 7 meters tall, and many weigh over 70 tons. These megaliths are exactly the same type as found all over rural Britain. And we also find them in Iran, Lebanon, Israel, Japan, and India, with a small number in America. And I think it's actually 60% of the world's megaliths are actually in Korea. And they were all built much later than the ones in Britain. The ones in Britain are about 3000 BC, and the ones in Korea are about 1500 BC, up to 1000 BC. So what I think happened is the white people that were in the Tarim Basin and making their way to India, making their way to China, they were also in Korea, where they set up these structures. I mean, you couldn't put these structures up in the Pamir Plateau, or the Taklamakan Desert, which is another term for it. But they obviously, they had stones which they could use in Korea. So they erected them in the same way that they did in Britain and all these other places. And we'll get more into this next week, because I want to really talk about the dolmens next week. But I think this is, really solid evidence, because it's something that we can go and look at in Britain. You know, you can see Stonehenge, you can go and have a look at any of the dolmens or the stone circles in Britain. And it's exactly the same thing that you see in Korea. And there's only one people that could have put them up. It's the same people, the same ethnicity, put them up here, that put them up over there. In Iran, they've got one that looks just like Avery that we have over here.
Right.
It's quite incredible to think. You know, it was the same people that were spread out all around the world, and they had the same technology. How do you do 70 ton capstone? How do you get a 70 ton capstone onto three uprights 3,000 years ago?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Neither do I.
But I wonder, I mean, as if it's not significant evidence enough, I wonder, is there any more evidence connecting the people to them, the same people to them, culturally or through other things like patterns or symbolism?
I think there are some patterns that you get, like this is another thing that we find as well, is a maze pattern. It's called a Troy Town maze. I mean, we might have talked about it. There's one in the Scilly Islands. There's one at Rocky Valley in Tintagel. And we also find them in Ireland. And we also find them in Crete. And this seems to have been an early symbol from the early civilizations, was this maze. And there's a similar one, I think, on the floor of one of the cathedrals in France, Chartres Cathedral or Notre Dame. And there's okay. a big maze that's on the floor. So that's a very old symbol. And you'd have to have a closer look at the megaliths that are actually there in Korea to see if they have them out there as well. But most people aren't even aware that these things exist. It's just not really talked about. And the link that it means that white people must have been all the way across this whole area thousands of years ago. And yet nobody talks about it. There are lots of people that are into megaliths, but most of them are sort of hippie types, and I guess they don't really think about it. Others, I guess they'd rather not investigate it because there are sort of questions like, well, how do they get these stones? How do they get a 70-ton capstone onto these other uprights? Because we still don't know how they're built. And also, these things are still standing today, thousands of years later. I mean, how many structures are we building today that are going to be here in 100 years' time, let alone 4,000 years' time?
True. Yeah, it does make you think. But, you know, it's amazing, really, how a lot of this knowledge is kind of just coming to the surface or to the attention of people like ourselves. And I think a lot of that's down to the internet. You know, in the Bible it talks about in the last days man's knowledge will increase. And it's obvious that it's almost inevitable that you know, information on past history would also unfold, you know, through the internet, through the sharing of information, and you know, the everything that's kind of been kind of started to surface from the past 100 years, including things on, you know, the world wars and the different side of stories that you didn't hear. It's all starting to kind of come out, and it takes time for it to spread again and for people to become conscious of it. And I guess the same thing is happening here through you know, the power of networking.
And through the internet. I think in the past, the equivalent of it was like the Great Library at Alexandria and places like that, where all the knowledge was held. I mean, we've lost so much of our knowledge. I think they think about 90% of all the knowledge that's ever been amassed has been completely lost. I mean, all the works that Flavius Josephus is quoting from are completely lost to us. And there were volumes and volumes of histories that had been written, which we just don't have any access to. But as you say, I mean, we do have the internet, and I think one of the original things is to be looking at it through the way that we're looking at it through the lens of ethnology and ethnicity, and how is it relevant to our people. And instead of looking at ourselves in a sort of parochial manner and saying, well we're just British people, we're just the British tribes, you know, looking at it and saying, well, this is the white race, this is our family, our extended family. And we've been everywhere throughout the world, and this is the history of our people before we even came to Britain. I think that's an original way to look at it, or at least it's an original way to look at it now. I think that was the way that a lot of these historians were looking at it 100 years ago, 150 years ago. But it's all hidden today. It's all there for us to rediscover it. But I think we should probably leave that here for this week. So thank you very much for coming on today.
You're welcome. It's been a good podcast today.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Next week, I believe we have a PA monthly update, and we will be back the Friday after that. So until then, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.